to the international community to spare no effort to urgently bring the parties involved to the negotiating table and to avoid a worsening of the already tragic humanitarian situation.
That's the Pope on Sunday. Your final 10-second comment, Shireen.
You know, I hope that your audience listening in realizes how much we've been involved in this country in this war on Yemen. It's an unjust war. We have no business being there, and I hope that they would call their senators, write to them, urge them to, you know, to end this war on Yemen.
We have to leave it there. Shireen Al-Adeimi, Yemeni scholar, just completed her doctoral degree at Harvard University, speaking out about the role of the U.S. in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. We'll link to your piece in These Times. That does it for our show. If you want to get our daily news headlines, send the word democracy now to 66866. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring an archive contractor for 40 hours a week for $20 an hour. This is a contract position that will last from July through December of 2018. The archive contractor will steward the KBOO archival assets in all forms. They will work with historical KBOO content in many audio formats, as well as the Resource Space Archival Database, documents of KBOO history, and KBOO staff and volunteers. Please send in a resume, cover letter, and answer the question, why is KBOO important, to del@kboo.org. That's del@kboo.org. More information about responsibilities and position requirements can be found at kboo.fm.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
One nation, one cause, one people, one tribe. Now it's us against the pipeline. Get on your feet for Standing Rock, and we'll show you how strong we could be when we unify.
KBOO hosts beloved community in action movie nights every third Thursday at 7 p.m. here at the radio station. June 21st, we'll show the documentary film Awake, A Dream from Standing Rock. Awake, A Dream from Standing Rock captures the story of Native-led defiance that changed the fight for clean water, the environment, and the future of our planet. Again, that's a screening of Awake for the KBOO Beloved Community in Action Movie Night on Thursday, June 21st at 7 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's been in decline since 1492, 500 years and counting. Surviving the genocide they call colonizing my turtle island. What is the...
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we take a look at the ongoing situation of children being separated at the border from their families.
We get a look at an update about last weekend's Pride Parade.
And we talk to Andrew Riley from the Amalgamated Transit Union.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 18th, 2018. I'm Natalie Motti.
And I'm Ken Jones. Oregon just received its report card from the organization Education Week for having some of the largest sized classrooms in the country. For more information, here's KBOO reporter Grace Ann Smith in conjunction with the Oregon News Service.
Oregon gets a failing grade for how much it spends on public schools, according to a new report. In its analysis, Education Week gave Oregon an F for spending and gave the state's overall education financing only slightly better marks, with a C-. Underfunding has been a persistent issue in Oregon schools. It's led to some of the largest class sizes in the nation. According to the National Education Association, the state had the sixth largest class sizes in the nation last year. John Larson, head of the Oregon Education Association, says even the best teachers struggle when class sizes are too big.
When you start talking about 45 students in a classroom, even the best instructor becomes more of a crowd management type of a person than they do an instructor. It's just not feasible for that person to be expected to deliver quality instruction with that many bodies in a classroom.
Although the graduation rate ticked up to nearly 77% last year, Oregon still has one of the lowest rates in the country. Larson says schools don't have the funding to give the attention to students who drop out of school. The lack of funding has led to cuts in other staff, such as counselors. Larson says Oregon is about $2 billion short of ranking average for education funding. He says state legislators have to make funding a priority during their next session.
We're going to be spending a lot of our time at their doors talking to them about why they need to fund our schools at an appropriate level. We're at a point right now where we simply cannot do more with less anymore. It's got to come from somewhere.
Despite its lack of spending, Education Week gives Oregon a B+ for equitable funding. Larson says that's because of a voter-passed measure where money is distributed by state to each pupil based on need. In conjunction with the KBOO Evening News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Grace Ann Smith.
According to the Oregonian, the ACLU of Oregon released a letter to the public claiming that 123 immigrants currently held by ICE at a federal prison in Sheridan are being denied access to legal representation. The ACLU letter states that detaining the immigrants, quote, in a federal prison is unjust, the forcible separation from their families is immoral, and their isolation from council and community is unfair, end quote. Last week, Innovation Law Lab and the American Immigration Lawyers Association chapter in Oregon also sent a letter to the prison's warden, offering pro bono legal representation for the immigrants being detained. Lawyers were able to meet with some of the detainees on Thursday, but lawyers were denied access on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. ACLU legal director Matt Dos Santos claims that meeting with every detainee could take weeks, since the Sheridan prison has only 4 meeting rooms with limited visiting hours, and calls to lawyers are prohibited at the prison. The ACLU demands in its letter that ICE officials allow the detained immigrants to have access to lawyers, as well as a library on immigration law. ACLU also calls for ICE to stop all deportation or interviews of the detainees until each detainee has met with legal counsel. The letter also demands an end to the separation of families at the border. ICE officials declared on June 7th that 1,600 people who were arrested at the U.S.-Mexico border would be detained across 5 states, with 123 of those detained being held in Sheridan. The ACLU claims that some of the men being held in Sheridan were separated from family when they were detained. Those separated from their families are still unaware of up-to-date information about their families. Tonight, from 5:30 p.m. to 7 p.m., a vigil will be held in support of the immigrants at the Sheridan Fishing Pond Southside Park. The ACLU's letter claims that, quote, the current administration has abandoned the American promise carved into the Statue of Liberty. Instead of welcoming the tired, poor, huddled masses, ICE is using the lives of refugees and asylum seekers to send a chilling message to the world. You are not welcome, and if you dare come, you will be punished. End quote.
A protest of around 200 people at the Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility in Southwest Portland yesterday did not end when the protest was over. Instead, a group of immigrant rights activists decided to set up an ongoing vigil outside of the ICE processing facility. They say they'll remain until the federal agency ends its so-called zero-tolerance policy and the city of Portland stops coordinating with and providing facilities for ICE. KBOO visited the vigil today and spoke with some of the activists.
My name is Rod Such, and I'm active in Palestine solidarity work in Portland, and also around immigrant rights issues. So I came down when I heard that there was an occupation, and I think we're at the point where we really need to start considering direct action and people committing civil disobedience to put an end to the outrages that are taking place. Children being separated from their parents has never been done before. It's a direct order from the Justice Department headed by Jeff Sessions, who is a notorious white supremacist. And, of course, President Donald Trump is directly responsible for this. So these kind of outrages have to stop.
Well, what do you think about Jeff Sessions' statement a few days ago that no longer will the U.S. provide asylum for people who are suffering from domestic violence and gang violence and are fleeing that type of violence?
It's the whole heartless aspect of this administration is no understanding of the conditions that people are fleeing, where literally they are fleeing to save their lives. Because of violence in their countries, because of extreme poverty. This country just has got it, been having it, getting it all wrong. You know, we have to start thinking of undocumented immigrants as economic refugees. In many cases, they are literally fleeing starvation conditions. And their only hope, they feel, is to get to the United States and be able to work.
Hello, I'm Jelana Canfield. And I am a Hillsborough mom showing solidarity that your children are lost. You might know the address where they're at, but that still means if they're not with their parents, they are missing, they are lost, they're being traumatized. We are affecting future human beings, fellow human beings, with trauma. These are children. We all come from either a parent, and so we all once were children. This could have been you, this could be your child, this could be your niece, it could be your neighbor. We need to stand in solidarity and support these families just trying to find a safe place. I understand if you don't support them coming here, but separating them is only going to cause more trauma and heartache.
Mm-hmm. And you said that you yourself are a mom. Is that part of what motivated you to come out to protest?
Yes. I used to protest before being a mom, but then once I was a mom, I kind of slowed down and got focused on my own, you know, middle-class American existence. And I realized, you know, if what I'm dealing with is the worst thing, but my child is always with me, I need to go out there and fight for other parents that have their child has been taken away just from trying to find a better life. And I feel confident that most of us in this country would do the same thing if there was bombs going off, shootings, drug lords taking control of our neighborhoods, famine.
Flee the situation.
You'd flee the situation. I also find this important because I remember in school asking teachers, how did the Holocaust or how did internment camps start if the average citizen didn't support concentration camps in Germany or internment camps here in the U.S.? And I remember what she said. She said, everyone just thought, oh, well, it's beyond what anything I can do, or it's not affecting my neighborhood. One day it will be your neighbors, just like then. So don't think that you're immune to the impact of this.
Can you tell us about how this action got started?
It grew out of the rally that had been at the McAdam processing and detention facility yesterday. And when people remained after the bulk of the rally was over, we decided we didn't want to go home. Not until the problem was solved. Because this is all being done in our names, whether we like it or not. So we want to call on any and all social justice orgs, churches, community groups, and concerned individuals to fight the purposeful destruction of our families and communities. As long as ICE is still occupying the building, though, we still want to be occupying here.
Has there been any police presence or police coming by?
So far, police presence has been limited but noticeable. They've done a few ride-bys on our camp. We've yet to have a major run-in. However, tonight at 8:30 p.m., we're having another candlelight vigil. It's going to be a larger gathering because a lot of the people who want to be here right now have to be at work or are at the other action in Sheridan, like you said. So at 8:30 p.m. tonight, bring a candle to 4310 Southwest McAdam and join us for something bigger.
So you're asking for people who are listening to come out this evening at 8:30 p.m.?
That is correct.
All right, 4310 Southwest McAdam. Mm. And if they are inclined to join the vigil more longer term, are you asking for more people to come as well?
Absolutely. If you want to join overnight, we have a Google Doc available. We are in the process of scheduling shifts to make sure there are people out here constantly, that we maintain a presence at this camp.
Again, we are at the vigil outside of the ICE facility at Southwest McAdam Avenue, and that is ongoing right now in Portland, Southwest McAdam, 4310 Southwest McAdam. For KBOO Radio, this is Jinka Soderberg.
The protesters say they plan to keep up the vigil indefinitely until ICE leaves Portland and stops the zero-tolerance policy. The building leased by ICE is located at 4310 Southwest McAdam Avenue in Portland. Ownership of the building is unclear, but the listed owner, the law firm of Kell, Alterman, and Runstein, did not return calls for comment before airtime today. The building's included on a page created by the Oregonian newspaper in 2013, listing properties that are delinquent in paying property taxes. 4310 Southwest McAdam is listed as owing $83,000 in back taxes.
According to the Washington Post, today President Trump doubled down on his false claim that Democrats are to blame for family separations at the U.S.-Mexico border. Last week, the Department of Health and Human Services announced that about 2,000 children have been taken from their parents or guardians in the 6 weeks since the Trump administration instituted its zero-tolerance immigration policy. DHS officials acknowledge that the number of separated children and parents may be even higher. Over Father's Day weekend, as thousands of children sat in detention centers separated from their parents, the Trump administration appeared divided as to its official stance concerning the immigration policy. While Trump continues to blame Democrats for the policy, nonpartisan fact-checking has proven that Trump signed off on the policy, which Attorney General Jeff Sessions promoted. Under Trump, the White House has reinterpreted a 1997 legal agreement along with a 2008 bipartisan bill concerning human trafficking to assert that those precedents require family separations at the border. Neither President George W. Bush nor President Barack Obama took that stance. On Sunday night, Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen tweeted that, quote, "We do not have a policy of separating families at the border, period," end quote. This followed on the heels of policy advisor Stephen Miller being quoted in the Sunday New York Times as saying, "It was a simple decision by the administration to have a zero-tolerance policy for illegal entry, period." Advisor Kellyanne Conway went on the same route as Trump, stating on NBC's Meet the Press that, "I will tell you that nobody likes this policy. Congress passed a law that it is a crime. This is a congressional law from many years ago." First Lady Melania Trump made a rare statement, weighing in through her spokeswoman Stephanie Grisham, saying that she, quote, "believes we need to be a country that follows all laws, but also a country that governs with heart," end quote. Sessions has continually defended the policy he helped bring to life, even attempting to justify the policy by citing the Bible, asserting, "I would cite to you the Apostle Paul, to obey the laws of the government because God has ordained the government for his purposes." Other Trump strategists who remained anonymous claimed that President Trump thinks that he can use family separations as a bargaining chip to get Democrats to concede on a larger deal involving funding for the border wall. While the Trump administration remains unclear on their official stance, thousands of immigrant children remain in detention centers while their parents and guardians are being held on criminal charges.
Vision Zero is a global initiative among municipalities to alter traffic flow and management, in an effort to drastically reduce crashes on roadways. Portland is taking steps to bring greater safety to its roads. According to Fortune, Portland's partnering with AT&T, Intel, and Current by GE, who will work with Portland General Electric in order to make three streets with high collision rates around the city safer. The effort is called Traffic Sensor Safety Project. The project will deploy 200 of what AT&T Vice President Michael Zito calls smartphones for municipalities, which combine cameras, microphones, and environmental sensors. These components can identify pedestrians, vehicles, and cyclists, triangulate the location of gunshots, and detect pollutants. With privacy a major concern with the project, the devices will purportedly retain no video. The software in the smartphones will process each object or piece of information and will only pass its analysis along rather than passing on the raw video. According to Zito, the system will not transfer any personally identifying information. This includes license plates, faces, and other information. Despite the fact the smartphones won't pass along any video, Zito also claims that cities will be able to store 7 days of video. He asserts that neither audio nor video will be sent in raw or streaming form to any central services. The project is a very small pilot compared to its sister project in San Diego, which is being executed by the same consortium of corporations. The San Diego project includes 3,000 sensors and 14,000 LED lights along the streets.
The smartphones used in Portland will be positioned along three streets, which between 2011 and 2015 had hundreds of collisions, some of which were fatal. The streets include 122nd Avenue between Burnside and Duke Street, Southeast Division between 11th and 122nd Avenues, and Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard between 11th and 46th Avenues. Smartphones will deliver data on how many vehicles, cyclists, and pedestrians pass along each street and at what speed each of them are moving. The city estimates the cost of the project to be about $1 million. Payment will be split between Portman Transportation Funds and contributions from corporate partners. Mayor Ted Wheeler said that, quote, "We are at the forefront of using advanced technology to make our cities safer for pedestrians, cyclists, and drivers, helping people more easily get around, save time, and reduce the possibility of crashes," end quote. Such projects can be risky for cities to fund, but with well-funded corporations backing the effort, the likelihood of the project folding or the corporations going bankrupt is unlikely. On Thursday, City Council will also vote on the city's Smart City PDX Priorities Framework, which proposes the use of more technology and data to, quote, "provide tangible benefits to the people of Portland," end quote.
Last weekend's Portland Pride parades went off without major incident, despite multiple organizations saying they had received warnings that counter-protesters were threatening harm to marchers of both the Trans Pride March on Saturday and the Portland Pride March on Sunday. Statements issued last Thursday and Friday from both Pride Northwest and Greater Portland Trans Unity referenced the possible violence, but said organizers had prepared well in advance for different scenarios regarding the safety of march participants. Apart from uninvited photographers and videographers at the Portland Trans Pride March being escorted from the start of the event, and a small LGBTQ hate group waiting for trans marchers near the South Pride entrance, marchers did not incur any violence during the routes. Beloved LGBTQ advocate group the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence stayed on the scene to surround the small counter-protest group with giant rainbow flags until Portland police arrived to remove the counter-protest group from the area.
The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, also known as the Mormon Church, has long barred same-sex couples from entering their information in the church's huge genealogical database. The church asserts that same-sex families are not families. Back in November of 2015, masses of Mormon members sent formal resignation letters from the church and marched past the Salt Lake Temple in protest of the Mormon Church's policies regarding LGBTQ people. Last Friday, the New Canaan News reported that the Mormon faith will begin accepting same-sex couples into the genealogical database sometime next year. According to a statement from the church, the move reportedly doesn't imply any changes in the Mormon faith's opposition to gay marriage, but is being done to ensure the database has as much information as possible for researchers. Church spokesman Irene Casso said, quote, "No judgments are made as to the legitimacy or character of the relationships found in these public records, nor can they be. They are simply collections of data to be assessed for their geological value by each researcher," end quote. The statement went on to say that several systems must be redesigned to make the submissions possible. Officials expect the work to be completed by 2109.
Climate Connections reports on climate change and how it affects our daily lives. On today's episode, a small town in Puerto Rico gets power from a new source, solar energy.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. 8 months after Hurricane Maria, power had still not been fully restored to the town of Mariana, Puerto Rico. So a company called Box Power shipped solar panels, batteries, and a backup generator to power a cafe, laundromat, and community center there. But unlike most renewable energy systems, this one snapped together almost like Legos, with no engineers or electricians needed.
If you can put together an IKEA bed frame, you can probably put together a microgrid system.
Angelo Campos founded Box Power. The company's portable power systems and tools needed to assemble them come in shipping containers.
The battery bank and generator can provide power from the minute it hits the ground, and the solar array can be set up in about 5 hours to provide a completely renewable source of energy.
Box Power plans to sell these systems for use at music festivals and other events. The company will donate them to communities recovering after disasters. Campos says the need for emergency power is growing with climate change.
With the frequency and severity of natural disasters increasing with every season, we are trying to position ourselves to bring reliable and clean power to the victims of those disasters globally when they strike.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Current Cast is a daily piece focused on one of our most precious resources, fresh water. On today's episode, algal blooms and its effects on pets.
For pets' sake, avoid the algae on this Current Cast. Too many nutrients in lakes and ponds can cause algae to grow out of control, producing harmful algal blooms. Some unleash toxins that threaten our health. And our animals, too. When ingested, touched, or even inhaled, they can make your pet sick or even die. So what can you do?
Well, the first step is prevention.
That's Karen Bischoff of Cornell University. She says you cannot tell by looking if a bloom makes toxins or not, so keep animals away. If you catch Fido in green, scummy water, remove him quickly and don't let him lick his paws or fur.
The best bet is to get him cleaned up as fast as possible and consult with a veterinarian.
When it comes to your precious pet, it's better to be safe than sorry. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future, supported by New York's Environmental Protection Fund and Sea Grant, online at currentcast.org.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. House of Representatives is focusing on opioids, but some Western lawmakers feel substance abuse issues in Indian country may be going unaddressed in the nation's capital. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
The U.S. House has been voting on a slew of opioid-related bills, and they're not done. The plan is to take up more than 30. Some deal with ensuring old pills are easily and safely disposed of, while others try to ensure the government has the best data on the crisis. Still others seek to prevent drugs from flowing in through the nation's many ports of entry, whether the southern or northern borders, or via a plane or ship. Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney says the bills are necessary.
I think they're really important, and I think we have a national crisis, and I think that it's important that, you know, the People's House be focused on the kinds of issues that are having such a devastating impact on communities across the country.
While the opioid crisis is claiming as many lives a year as were lost in the entire Vietnam War, there's a growing number of voices who fear Congress is diverting attention from other more long-standing substance abuse problems.
In Alaska, it's alcohol, has been alcohol, will be alcohol.
In Montana and among Montana's Indian tribes, meth is actually more of our issue.
It's definitely the biggest problem out there.
Those are Republican Senators Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Steve Daines of Montana, and the last voice was Wyoming's Mike Enzi, who says Congress has spent enough time on opioids so far.
It's taking attention away from a lot of things. We've already passed 7 bills that deal with the opioid crisis, and we still have one. So there are going to have to be some different kinds of solutions.
Enzi's not saying the opioid crisis isn't worthy of attention from officials, but he says those officials helping stem the tide don't necessarily have to come from Washington.
Every problem doesn't have a federal solution. It just doesn't. And that's why probably 7 bills haven't worked.
Congresswoman Cheney begs to differ with a growing number of lawmakers out west complaining about the attention the opioid crisis is getting.
I don't think it's a distraction. I think opioids have not been as big a challenge for us right now in Wyoming as they have been in some other parts of the country. But I think it's really important, you know, for us to be focused on it. And frankly, it doesn't distract from the larger challenges that we have.
For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
The Tohono O'odham Nation in Arizona says its police, along with federal agencies, are investigating an incident involving the U.S. Border Patrol and a tribal member. In a statement, the tribe says it's aware of disturbing video footage posted online showing a Border Patrol vehicle appearing to be involved in a hit and run. The video shows a man filming a Border Patrol vehicle driving toward him and then hitting him. As he falls to the ground, the man can be heard reading the license plate saying, "They ran me over." The vehicle drives away and does not stop. The incident occurred last week in a Tohono O'odham community close to the U.S.-Mexico border. The 34-year-old man was taken to the hospital and released. The statement by the tribe released on Friday did not provide further details. The video was posted on social media sites and has been shared and viewed thousands of times. Leaders of the Navajo Nation are opposing a request by a group of New Mexico state lawmakers seeking to nullify a water settlement between the state and tribe. The legislators Friday filed a petition in the New Mexico Supreme Court over the San Juan River water settlement. It was approved and signed by Congress in 2010. The petition claims the agreement must be submitted to the state legislature for consideration. New Mexico courts have rejected other challenges to the settlement. Tribal leaders say the settlement reaffirms Navajo Nation water rights to the San Juan River Basin. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Andrew Riley from the Amalgamated Transit Union. At 6, it's Labor Radio. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather. In Portland and east of the Cascades in Hood River, it will be in upper 50s to low 60s, followed by partly cloudy skies and a high of 90 degrees. Today in history. The lesser-known but equally prestigious scientist Alfred Russel Wallace had his paper received by Charles Darwin in 1858. Wallace was a scientist also working in a hypothesis of evolution through natural selection. This prompted Darwin to publish his own findings with the release of his book, The Origin of Species. The quote of the day is from Alfred Russel Wallace. "We permit absolute possession of the soil of our country, with no legal rights of existence on the soil to the vast majority who do not possess it. A great landholder may legally convert his whole property into a forest or a hunting ground and expel every human being who has hitherto lived upon it. In a thickly populated country like England, where every acre has its owner and its occupier, this is a power of legally destroying his fellow creatures. And that such a power should exist and be exercised by individuals, in however small a degree, indicates that, as regards true social science, we are still in a state of barbarism." And now it's time for Labor History in 2 from our host, Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1935. That was the day more than 1,000 locked-out dock workers battled police forces in Vancouver, British Columbia, in the Battle of Ballantyne Pier. The dispute began weeks earlier when the Shipping Federation locked out dock workers at Powell River using scabs to unload and load cargo. Shipping magnates feared communist leadership had taken over the company unions they established in the 1920s. Workers at other ports in British Columbia now refused to handle Powell River cargo and were also locked out. Hot cargoing was the main issue, but dockers also demanded higher wages, union recognition, and fair dispatching. The previous year's West Coast waterfront strike had put dock workers everywhere in a fighting mood. In Vancouver, dockers ousted management lackeys from their union and voted in a radical leadership during a recent election. Shipping bosses, local politicians, and businessmen all cried Bolshevik menace. They formed a Citizens League and prepared for battle. And on this day, striking dockers marched to Ballantyne Pier, where they had been denied the right to picket. They were determined to stop the scabbing and intended to confront the scabs directly. Led by World War I veteran Mickey O'Rourke, dockers were abruptly stopped at the pier entrance by Vancouver police. Immediately, they were beaten and tear-gassed by club-wielding police and despised specials. Soon, British Columbia Provincial Police and Royal Canadian Mounted Police emerged to join in on the assault. The fighting continued for 3 hours. Police horses trampled many as they tried to escape. Scores were hospitalized and arrested. The strike dragged on for months and ended in defeat. But dockers would win the war through 10 years of hard, dedicated organizing that culminated with an ILWU charter in 1945.
The Public News Service is a member-supported media organization that aims to keep the news honest. On today's roundup, Melania Trump issues a statement on the practice of detaining children, anti-hunger advocates get a win with the passing of a new bill, and the burden of diaper duty.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, June 18, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. First Lady Melania Trump makes a statement against separating kids from parents. Also on the Monday rundown, anti-hunger advocates applaud the newest farm bill. Plus, diaper duty is an economic burden for 1 in 3 families. Now our top story, First Lady Melania Trump urged both sides of the aisle to come together to stop federal authorities from separating children from their parents when apprehended at the border. The New York Times reports this was a rare public intervention in an issue that has generated enormous criticism of her husband. In a statement issued by her office, the First Lady expressed empathy for affected families, saying the country should be governed with a heart, but did not directly take issue with Trump's policy, instead saying both sides need to agree. Immigration rights advocates in Arizona and around the country are continuing to speak out against the Department of Homeland Security separating migrant children from their parents. We get the details from Catherine Davis Young.
About 2,000 children were separated from their families at the U.S.-Mexico border this spring, according to the Associated Press. The separations come as a result of a stricter Homeland Security policy to prosecute all adults who cross the border unlawfully. Since kids aren't charged with crimes, the department won't detain them with their parents. Petra Falcone is with immigrant rights organization Promise Arizona.
We as a nation need to pay attention to this, and we need some answers and some action to what this crisis is making these children live through.
Falcone's organization has joined together with Arizona religious leaders to condemn the family separations. Politicians from both parties, including Republican Arizona Senator Jeff Flake, have expressed concerns over removing children from their parents.
Over the weekend, Promise Arizona held a Father's Day vigil to call attention to the parents and children who couldn't spend the holiday together. And as Congress works to reauthorize a new farm bill by the end of September, Ross Brown reports those working to end hunger in the U.S. are encouraged that the latest version would help and not punish.
The comprehensive bill covers SNAP as well as farm subsidies, trade, and rural development policy. Colleen Moriarty with Hunger Solutions Minnesota says the farm bill is the biggest funding opportunity for anti-hunger work in the nation.
The Senate farm bill is a real signal of hope for the fact that we can come up with a farm bill that both helps agriculture and doesn't hurt poor people.
The farm bill is usually renewed every 5 years, and the current version is set to expire September 30th.
The total benefits paid out last year by SNAP nationwide were about $63 billion and went to more than 42 million Americans. And in a blow to the legislative branch in the Sunshine State, a Tallahassee judge has ruled that Florida lawmakers wrongly diverted money meant for buying and preserving environmentally sensitive lands.
On Friday, Leon Circuit Judge Charles Dotson sided with environmental groups in the lawsuit about whether lawmakers defied the 2014 Florida Water and Land Conservation Initiative, known as Amendment 1. Attorney David Guest, who represents groups such as the Florida Wildlife Federation and the Sierra Club, called the ruling a victory because after the constitutional amendment was approved by 75% of voters, he said lawmakers started nitpicking to avoid following the will of the people.
They had looked at commas, and they had come up with exotic definitions of words and ways of reading that that made it so they could do anything they wanted, and what they wanted to do was no buying land.
Fred Piccolo, a spokesman for House Speaker Richard Corcoran, called the ruling a clear abuse of judicial authority. He added that he's confident it will be overturned on appeal. Guest expects the case will be sent directly to the state Supreme Court for a final decision. I'm Tramell Gomes.
The ruling now postpones a week-long trial that was planned for July. And finally, diaper duty can certainly be stressful, and for some parents, it's a stress on not just their patients, but also their wallets. Here's Mary Sherman.
Nearly one in three families in the U.S. is affected by diaper need, which is a lack of access to clean diapers during the newborn, infant, and toddler years of a child's life. Elizabeth Roshan with the Association of Women's Health, Obstetric and Neonatal Nurses explains an ample supply of diapers for just one child can cost families anywhere from $70 to $120 a month.
For some families, they're probably thinking that's nothing. But for other families, that amount of money is a considerable burden that really creates an economic hardship for those families to be able to afford clean diapers on a regular basis.
Roshan adds 3 out of 5 parents report missing work or school because they don't have enough diapers to send their little one to childcare or early education programs. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program and other public assistance programs do not cover the cost of diapers, but there is a national diaper bank network with local agencies providing assistance in 46 states. When a baby's skin is not consistently kept clean and dry, skin problems such as yeast infections can occur. But Roshan explains some parents have no other alternatives than to stretch their diaper supply.
Families who struggle with clean diapers or who struggle with a lack of clean diapers reuse diapers or will use diapers to a point where they're no longer safe to use against a baby's skin.
It's estimated that 2 million children age 5 and under don't have all the diapers they need to stay clean and stay dry. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for starting your week. News and Cruisin' with Public News Service. We are member listener supported and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
Last Thursday, KBOO profiled 5 World Cup games worth watching over the weekend, and none of the games disappointed. Spain versus Portugal was a fantastic game, ending 3-3, thanks to a vintage Cristiano Ronaldo free kick in the 88th minute, which tied the game. Ronaldo notched a hat-trick and looked unstoppable. Spain came from behind twice before taking the lead through a superb volley from defender Nacho. The hotly contested match may prove to be one of the best of the entire tournament. Argentina faced heavy underdog Iceland in what should have been an easy win for the lethal Argentinian side. It was not to be, though. Argentina and Iceland tied 1-1 thanks to 2 early goals. That result is more than Iceland could have hoped for and may spur them on to reach the round of 16. Croatia bested Nigeria 2-0 behind captain Luka Modric. The Nigerian attack couldn't find their rhythm and Croatia punished them for it. In a huge upset, Mexico downed reigning champions Germany 1-0. The impressive Mexican side outworked the talented Germans, and Mexico got their just reward of 3 points. Mexico earned the win after maintaining their narrow lead under immense pressure from Germany late in the game. Belgium had no such issues in their match against Panama. The Belgians brushed aside Panama 3-0 in Panama's first ever World Cup appearance. Dries Mertens scored a wonder volley to kick things off, and Romelu Lukaku continued his incredible form with 2 goals of his own, sealing an easy win for Belgium. The first 5 days of the tournament reminded us of one thing: anything can happen in the World Cup.
The enticing games keep on coming, starting early on Tuesday morning.
At 5 a.m. on Tuesday, Colombia take on Japan in what should be an even match. Group H includes Colombia, Japan, Poland, and Senegal, and any of the four teams could go through to the round of 16. Colombia and Japan have great quality in their teams and both play very attractive soccer. This match should be very fun to watch and may fly under many fans' radar. Also on Tuesday morning, World Cup hosts Russia take on Egypt at 11 a.m. Russia thrashed Saudi Arabia 5-0 to start the tournament, whereas Egypt lost their opener to Uruguay 1-0 in the dying moments of the match. Unfortunately for Russia, this time around Egypt's main man Mohamed Salah should be fit to play. Due to a previous injury, Salah was kept on the bench out of precaution against Uruguay, but he is expected to take the field against Russia tomorrow morning. Salah can change a game and tear apart opponents in a flash. With Salah on the pitch, this match will be a joy to watch. On Wednesday at 11 a.m., Spain take on Iran. Iran find themselves on top of the group and ahead of Spain after the Spaniards played to an electric 3-3 draw against Portugal. Iran beat Morocco in stoppage time and have an unexpected leg up going into this match. Spain has immense quality all over the pitch, and barring a shocking performance, they should bag 3 points against Iran. An upset is always in the cards, but Spain's overwhelming talent should lead them to an easy win.
France takes on Peru on Thursday at 8 a.m. in what may be a tricky match. France snuck past Australia with an unconvincing 2-1 victory to start the tournament. Peru lost to Denmark 1-0 in a match that Peru should have won, and they know that a loss in this match against France could lead to their elimination from the tournament. Peru's dangerous and fast on the counterattack, but France has weapons all over the pitch. If France can find their footing, they should win easily, but if Peru can put the French off balance, we may have another huge upset on our hands. On Thursday at 11 a.m., Argentina takes on Croatia. Croatia sits atop Group D after a strong performance against Nigeria, while Argentina sits in third following their shock tie against Iceland. If Argentina continues to stumble, Croatia has more than enough firepower to beat them. Luka Modric and Ivan Rakitic will be key to creating chances for Croatia, but if Lionel Messi and his supporting cast come alive in this match, it will be quite a show. Check back in on Thursday for an update on the results of these matches, as well as information on more tantalizing matches to come.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is CJ Fritz and Ken Jones. The producer is Grace Ann Smith. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Ellis Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Natalie Motti.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up Tuesday morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9, we'll hear alternative radio and political perspectives. At 10, it's Air Cascadia with Chris Andre. And at 10:15, it's Flashpoints, followed by D. May Roberts and Stage and Studio at 11 a.m. At 11:30 a.m., it's Art Focus. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support to keep informed
and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on donate to become a member. Good night, Natalie. Good night, Danielle.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Danielle.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You may have seen those smaller TriMet shuttles in your neighborhood, independent of the regular public buses. These shuttles are part of the special TriMet Lyft paratransit service, which mostly serves people with disabilities and the elderly. While the Lyft service is overseen by TriMet, it's outsourced to a company called First Transit, which is part of the multinational corporation First Group. The Portland Area Workers' Rights Board is currently gathering testimony from Lyft drivers and riders about labor and human rights violations they've experienced since First Transit took over the Lyft service. In addition to gathering the testimony, the Workers' Rights Board is also seeking solutions. To find out more, we're fortunate to have with us in the KBOO studios right now, we have Andrew Riley, Kathy Redwine, and Barbara Diamond. Andrew, I know you're the communications coordinator for Amalgamated Transit Union Local 757. Kathy and Barbara, can you tell us a little bit about yourselves, your connection to the Lyft hearings?
I'm on the board of the Jobs for Justice, and they asked me to sit on the board because I am a civil rights attorney and a union lawyer.
And you're Kathy?
Barbara,
okay. I had 50-50. I'm sorry.
Barbara,
okay. Kathy, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I'm Kathy Redwine. I'm the liaison officer for Region 2 Lyft out of Beaverton, Oregon, for First Transit.
Now, I want to start off first a little bit about the TriMet Lyft paratransit service, whoever feels they can answer this the best, because we have three of you in the studio. I appreciate that. What does the Lyft service do, and who does it serve?
It mostly serves elders and people with disabilities, a lot of whom have come out of the institutions that they deinstitutionalized in the 80s, I believe it was 80s and 90s, and they live in group homes now, and they made a mandate where you have to transport them to a group workshop, and they have to be out of their group home so many hours every day. And that's where the Lyft buses come in, because we transport them to their workshops or to the doctor or wherever they need to go, and then we go back and pick them up. Anytime service is booked for these people, they have a round trip guaranteed.
And this is overseen, the service, as I mentioned, is overseen by TriMet, but it's actually outsourced to an independent company, and that's First Transit?
Yes.
And is that a recent development, or has that been true from the very beginning of the Lyft service?
It was in-house to start with, and I don't know what year they actually put them out for contract, but I know Mayflower was one of the first contractors, and there's been, I believe, six contractors in the last 35 years. First Transit, I believe, came into being about 2007.
So in those 11 years, has the service changed much from previous contractors, meaning were there violations to drivers and riders also under other outsourced companies, or is it just started with First Transit?
Well, there's always been a few violations, but First Transit is pushing on-time performance and number of customer rides per hour more than any of the other services that I know anything about. I first worked for Laidlaw, and we had an issue where we had to have our passengers off the bus in an hour or an hour and a half tops. Now that doesn't seem to be a problem anymore. Some of our passengers are on for 3 hours or more. And when they don't have the cognitive skills to understand why, they get very agitated. They're not equipped, especially if they're in wheelchairs, to be riding around for hours in the bus. And we're not caregivers, so if they have special needs that they need somebody to attend to, they can't be attended to until we drop them off at their drop-off location.
Now, Barbara, if you want to take this, as mentioned in the intro, the Workers' Rights Board's currently hearing testimony about labor and human rights violations experienced by the drivers and the riders here, as Kathy told us. What is the Workers' Rights Board, and how do these violations come to the board's attention?
Well, the Workers' Rights Board is put together groups of experts, including professors, public officials, attorneys, and people affected, people from groups that are interested in civil rights and workers' rights. And we're put together to make sure that we have the depth of expertise to analyze these issues.
And you've conducted your first hearing. That was last month, right, in May?
Yes, and it was really a very well attended. We had people who were from the community who are experiencing disabilities, although it does include severely impaired folks who might have in the past lived at Fairview. It also includes a wide variety of people who are not quite as severely disabled, and it's a way for people who use wheelchairs or other forms of who have other forms of access needs to basically do anything they would need to do in the community. And the problem that we saw explained to us is that the system doesn't seem to be created to allow people to actually work if they're capable of working, because there's no guarantee that people can be picked up and delivered on time to work in the morning and picked up in the evening on time. Because if you have to wait 3 hours, there's no workplace that's going to let you wander in several hours late, and that's just not a sustainable thing. So what we're finding is that rather than encouraging people to contribute to society and having the benefit to society of the full inclusion of people with disabilities, you know, the system itself is disadvantaging not only the riders, but the people who work in the system as well. So it's really a double-edged sword that way.
It's not really doing what it's was formed to do, to help people with disabilities and help them get to work or whatever they need to get to on time.
Or go to church or go out on a date or do anything that people without disabilities are able to do in our mass transit system. And that deprives the community of the luscious contributions that people with disabilities would make. You know, it's not only a question of helping people with disabilities. It's the fact that we as a society would do better with the active engagement of all of our citizens in the community, not just people who are non-disabled.
Now, Andrew, you're with the Amalgamated Transit Union Local 757. I have a two-part question for you. What's the union's role in these hearings? And I'm interested in what First Transit's response has been to these complaints and these violations.
Yeah, so the union's kind of interest and role in this is we represent the operators and dispatchers at all three regions providing paratransit service. It's about 390 members. And we have been hearing story after story about the treatment our folks are facing in the workplace. And some seem common to the paratransit industry across the U.S., but some also seem really focused from First Transit. And so over the last couple of years, we've worked, in particular our organizers, Jared Franz and Krista Cordova, to put together what we call a paratransit conference to bring folks from across Oregon and Southern Washington together to really talk about what's common and what can we do better industry-wide. And this Workers' Rights Board hearing or the idea of working with Jobs with Justice to hold it really came out of that. In terms of First Transit's response, you know, we've gotten a little bit of a hint about one positive change. One thing we heard loud and clear from our folks is around scheduling. And so often we'll have folks who are scheduled to pick up passengers or start work about 4 a.m., 5 a.m., and you can't call in to get your schedule for that day until the night before at about 8 o'clock. Well, if you got to get up to get to work by 4 a.m., you've got to go to bed sooner than 8. And so that's been a big challenge, in particular because there are what we call hours of service regulations in the transit industry, where you have to get a certain amount of sleep every night. You don't want your operator, you know, asleep at the wheel.
Of course, that's where the union comes in.
Absolutely. We've been fighting for those for years. And so we have heard that First has committed to providing folks with their schedules at 6 p.m. the night before. We haven't seen that manifest necessarily. But they...
Oh, I have to interrupt you, Andrew. I'm sorry, because we have just about a minute or so left.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to make sure the listeners knew how they could participate. I know there's an event coming up at the end of June. Andrew, did you want to tell us about that real quickly and where our listeners can find out more information?
It's like you knew that there was a shameless plug on my paper here. yeah, so next Monday, June 25th, we're hosting the follow-up event with Jobs with Justice and the Real Choice Initiative. It's called a Speak Out for Accessibility in Transit and Housing. It's going to be 6 to 8 p.m. at the SEIU 503 Union Hall. It's 6401 Southeast Foster Road here in Portland. From 6 to 6:30, we'll have a solidarity rally with workers and riders together. And then from 6:30 to 8, we'll hear open mic testimony from predominantly from community members, folks with disabilities, but also from workers as well about the challenges they're facing and what we can do to fix it.
Well, thanks very much for all three of you for coming down here. Andrew Riley, Kathy Redwine, and Barbara Diamond. We've been talking with, as I mentioned, Andrew, Kathy, and Barbara, and you can learn more about the Workers' Rights Board and the LIFT hearings at the Portland Jobs with Justice website, JWJPDX, JWJPDX.org. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
One nation, one cause, one people, one tribe. Now it's us against the pipeline. Get on your feet for Standing Rock, and we'll show you how strong we could be when we unify.
KBOO hosts beloved community and action movie nights every third Thursday at 7 p.m. here at the radio station. June 21st, we'll show the documentary film Awake, A Dream from Standing Rock. Awake, A Dream from Standing Rock captures the story of Native-led defiance that changed the fight for clean water, the environment, and the future of our planet. Again, that's a screening of Awake for the KBOO Beloved Community in Action Movie Night on Thursday, June 21st at 7 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's been in decline since 1492, 500 years and counting. Surviving the genocide they call colonizing my turtle island.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Building Bridges, Tearing Down Walls on Sunday, June 24th at 5 p.m. at the Sunnyside Community House in Portland. Building Bridges, Tearing Down Walls features the screening of Dare to Dream, a 30-minute documentary on U.S. students who graduated from the Latin American School of Medicine in Havana, Cuba. John Waller, the National Caravan Coordinator for Pastors for Peace, will speak about how, in 1959, the Cuban people dared to dream a different future for their country, and how the U.S. government has been trying to destroy that dream by economic blockade. Again, that's Building Bridges, Tearing Down Walls on Sunday, June 24th at 5 p.m. at the Sunnyside Community House, 3520 Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland. More